content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello and welcome to our October 2020 edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. This program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. The Friends Group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you'd like to join the Friends Group yourself, we'll have information on how to do that later in this program. This program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. The library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well. The library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state. And if you're not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information at the end of this program. This month, we'll take a look at some of the most popular books checked out within the past few months at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. So glad you could join me for the program today. We'll begin with a book entitled The Indifferent Stars Above, The Harrowing Saga of the Donner Party by Daniel James Brown. Here's the plot. In April of 1846, 21-year-old Sarah Graves, intent on a better future, set out west from Illinois with her new husband, her parents, and eight siblings. 7 months later, after joining a party of emigrants led by George Donner, they reached the Sierra Nevada Mountains as the first heavy snows of the season closed the pass ahead of them. In early December, starving and desperate, Sarah and 14 others set out for California on snowshoes and over the next 32 days endured almost unfathomable hardships and horrors. In this gripping narrative, Daniel James Brown sheds new light on one of the most infamous events in American history. Following every painful footstep of Sarah's journey with the Donner Party, Brown produces a tale that is both spellbinding and richly informative. Again, the name of that book is The Indifferent Stars Above, The Harrowing Saga of the Donner Party, and that was written by Daniel James Brown. Our next book for today is one entitled Fatal Judgment, and it's by Irene Hannon, and this is from a review by Revel Books. Here's the plot for this one. U.S. Marshal Jake Taylor is assigned to protect Liz Michaels, a federal judge, after an unknown assailant kills her sister. But the judge and her protector have an unsettled personal history that may complicate his assignment in Fatal Judgment, the first romantic suspense novel in the Guardians of Justice series by Irene Hannon. Jake's best friend, Doug Michaels, now dead, was married to Liz. Doug drove his car into a tree, killing himself, and Jake blames Liz for literally driving him to his death. He hasn't seen her since the funeral, but he knows that he needs to set aside any personal issues he may have with Liz in order to do his job. The authorities initially suspect that Liz's sister's ex-husband is the killer. They were estranged, and he had vowed to get back at her for divorcing him. But his solid alibi and the fact that Liz and her sister have a similar appearance suggests that possibly Liz might have been the target all along. Fatal Judgment, a novel heavy on romance and relationships, yet exceptionally light on suspense, according to the reviewer, is fast reading, but not fast paced. Indeed, the plot moves along in a pace that can best be described as leisurely, made more so by how predictable it is. May be comfortably expected is a better way to describe it. A lot of time is spent examining Liz's relationship with her dead husband, Jake's relationship with his dead wife, Jake's past and current relationship with Liz, and Jake's relationship with his brother and sister, and so on. The suspense element is largely eliminated when the killer is introduced fairly early and given his own point of view. This is all standard fare for a novel of romantic suspense, and would be well and good if it weren't so illogical. Ironically, Liz sums it up when she's taken hostage. Why not just kill her? Well, there were plenty of silent ways to eliminate someone. Why take the risk of spiriting her away to another location? It wasn't logical. And given the methodical way the man had thought this through, he wasn't some half-cocked nutcase. He had a reason for doing it this way. Yet that reason is never really made clear. The remaining chapters playing out in a surprisingly uneventful manner. Well, there actually is some appeal to fatal judgment, and readers familiar with the author or the genre will almost certainly be satisfied with the book. But there are likely to be some who will wonder why more thought wasn't put into crafting a more credible storyline. And again, that was a review, not just a straight-up description of the plot there. And the review was done by, I pronounced it Revel, it's probably Revel Books. And that was Fatal Judgment, and it was by Irene Hannon. And although the review was not that favorable, in fact, it was quite unfavorable, which we read sometimes on this program, it was one of the top 10 most popular books at the North Carolina Library for the Blind last month. So it might be worth checking out. Now let's move on to another book for this program. This one is entitled Lake Season, and it's by Denise Hunter. Here's the plot. When their parents die in a tragic accident, Molly Bennett and her siblings pull together to fulfill their parents' dream, turning their historic home back into an inn. Adam Bradford, also known as best-selling author Nathaniel Gray, is a reclusive author with a bad case of writer's block. Deadline approaching and desperate for inspiration, he travels to a North Carolina lake town, the setting of his next novel. There he immediately meets his muse, a young innkeeper who fancies herself in love with his alter ego. Well, when Molly finds an old letter in the walls of her inn, she embarks on a mission to find the star-crossed lovers and bring them the closure they deserve. But the guest she invites along has a secret of his own, and the answers Molly finds may not be the ones that she was looking for. Sounds pretty intriguing. It's called Lake Season by Denise Hunter. Well, we don't have too many nonfiction books in our top 10 list at the Library for the Blind each month, but here's one that was extremely popular during the month of September. This one is called Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote by Ellen Carroll Du Bois. UCLA history professor Du Bois, co-editor of Unequal Sisters, delivers a comprehensive and well-paced account of the 75-year campaign for women's voting rights in the U.S., disputing claims that women's suffrage was a single-issue crusade marred by the fatal flaw of racism. Du Bois details the movement's roots in the temperance and abolitionist causes, highlights suffragists' advocacy for trade unions, birth control, and other social justice issues, and contextualizes the exclusion of black women from the mainstream suffrage movement in the Jim Crow era. She documents Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony's leadership of the first national universal suffrage campaign in the 1850s, and details the schism within the movement that developed during debates over the enfranchisement of free black men after the Civil War. At the turn of the 20th century, suffragist leaders focused on changing state voting laws, while anti-lynching activist Ida B. Wells and others fought to desegregate the movement. In 1912, Quaker reformer Alice Paul launched the constitutional campaign that led to the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920. Du Bois rightly focuses on the colorful personalities that define the distinct eras of suffragism and effectively marshals a wealth of source material. This thorough, even-handed presentation offers valuable lessons for readers interested in women's rights and the history of progressive activism in America. Once again, this, what sounds like a very excellent book, is called Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote by Ellen Carroll Du Bois. I guess with all of the reality that we're all facing during this year of 2020, the books that are nonfiction are more popular than ever before. I just mentioned we usually don't have too many. We actually have, I think, three or four during this program. The next one is one I'm going to read right now, is a book called Get Out of Your Head, Stopping the Spiral of Toxic Thoughts, and it's written by Jenny Allen. And this is a review that was posted in March by Karen Kinnaird. The greatest spiritual battle of our generation is being fought between our ears, contends Jenny Allen in her latest popular book, Get Out of Your Head, Stopping the Spiral of Toxic Thoughts. Noting we are what we think, it's Allen's passion to help people capture false, destructive thoughts with the interruption, we have a choice, and deliberately build healthy thought patterns and sound minds based on the truth of God's Word. Published in 2020 by Waterbrook, Get Out of Your Head is timely and transformational. Allen is a popular podcaster, sought-after speaker, and a Bible teacher, and author of several books and study guides. She is also a founder and visionary of IF Gathering, an organization that equips women to know God more deeply and to disciple others. In Get Out of Your Head, Allen draws from scientific research, findings from mental health professionals, biblical truths, and her own experiences. As she candidly shares her own story of a dark season, living with lies that resulted in fear, anxiety, and doubt. When she recognized this was an attack by the enemy and began fighting the lies as if she was in a battle, things started to change. It was this season that prompted the writing of the book, a book she states was by a million miles the most difficult. Allen teaches about retraining the mind with weapons God has given us to combat seven strategic enemies, such as combating busyness with stillness before God, combating fear with trusting that God is in control, and combating cynicism with delight in God. One of the things I loved about the book, says the reviewer, is the practical way that Allen gets to the root of self-defeating, self-denigrating thoughts with a clear action plan to redirect thoughts. With the goal of being conformed to the mind of Christ, she suggests a spiral model. She recommends using a downward spiral for negative thoughts, and upward spiral for rewriting positive, truthful thoughts. Readers can identify the emotion, thought, behavior, effect on relationships, and consequence of the emotion. This is a life-changing way to get rid of toxic thoughts. While Get Out of Your Head addresses a heavy topic, the book is easy to read and written in a conversational style. This book would be beneficial for anyone desiring to get out of their head, but particularly those struggling with fear, anxiety, doubt, negativity, or complacency. Allen shows that there is hope. It is possible to take every thought captive and let Christ transform our minds. Other resources to accompany this book include a six-session Bible study entitled Get Out of Your Head, based on the book of Philippians, and a book club kit with conversation questions, activities, and worksheets, and podcast episodes for each week. For more information about this, you can go to jennyallen.com, and that's J-E-N-N-I-E, by the way, jennyallen.com. That was a very popular book in September at the Library for the Blind, and I think it's one you might enjoy. Again, it's called Get Out of Your Head, Stopping the Spiral of Toxic Thoughts by Jenny Allen. Now, one more nonfiction book for this program, and this is another one that I think is very, very timely these days. It is called Why We're Polarized, and it's by Ezra Klein. Ezra Klein is the editor-at-large and co-founder of Vox, the award-winning explanatory news organization. Launched in 2014, Vox reaches more than 50 million people across its platforms each month. Klein is also the host of the podcast, The Ezra Klein Show, co-host of the Weeds podcast, and an executive producer of Vox's Netflix show, Explained. Previously, Klein was a columnist and editor at The Washington Post, a policy analyst at MSNBC, and a contributor to Bloomberg. He's written for The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books, and he's appeared on many programs, including Face the Nation, The Daily Show, and the PBS NewsHour. Guest writer Thomas Simpson offers a review of journalist Ezra Klein's new book, Why We're Polarized. Thomas himself holds a master's degree in history from Georgetown University and is a core member of Facing History's marketing and communications team. Here is the review by Simpson. The 2020 election has been conspicuously different from past presidential campaigns. Digital party conventions, canceled swing state rallies, and the ongoing fight over mail-in ballots are just some of the ways that the COVID-19 pandemic has shaken up the usual quadrennial rituals of American politicking. Yet Biden voters and Trump voters alike would agree with the sentiment that one trend in American politics has only grown stronger this year, the polarization of the two parties. Well, more to the point, there's an assumption that such polarization is unambiguously bad, something that poses a grave threat to the fabric of American society. Admittedly, as an avid consumer of political news myself, these are things that I've also thought about increasingly over the past decade. More, however, Vox Media co-founder Ezra Klein's new book, Why We're Polarized, seeks to add some nuance to our understanding of this strange place in history where seemingly everything in the United States has become a polarizing issue, including, say, the practice of wearing masks during a pandemic. While Klein is quick to point out some of the unfortunate excesses of polarization, he's not interested in blaming one particular politician or another for escalating the rancor of our national discourse. Rather, Klein wants to demystify this phenomenon by drawing our attention to studies from the fields of political science and psychology. Above all, Klein wants us to think in terms of systems and feedback loops rather than focusing solely on headline-grabbing personalities like Donald Trump or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Polarization is a process, not an end point. More than that, it's a cycle that everyone engaged in the political process is affected by, including the average voter. Partisan elites are more polarized than the general voting public to begin with, but as that public tunes more and more into political news, they themselves take up the polarized positions of the elites. This, in turn, incentivizes politicians to double down on these positions because they see that they're popular with their constituents. The reason we're all susceptible to this feedback loop, in Klein's estimation, is because identity politics have triumphed over more transactional material issues. In this book, Klein attempts to complicate our understanding of identity politics amid its often narrow use as a pejorative against positions expressed by individuals in marginalized communities. In the contemporary United States, almost all political questions are questions of identity, he asserts. If this seems new to the American experience, that's because it's a departure from the political alignment of the mid-20th century, when both the Democratic and Republican parties were big tents with conservative and liberal factions. In this previous era, being a Democrat or a Republican didn't signify much in terms of a person's identity. That all changed in the decades since the 1970s, as Democrats became the party of liberals, Republicans that of conservatives. And Klein rightly highlights the centrality of issues of race as he narrates this realignment process. Modern research into the science of personality also reveals that there are certain psychological traits that predispose individuals toward being more liberal or conservative. That is, those who score higher in the dimension of openness are more liberal. Those who score higher in the dimension of conscientiousness are more conservative. In the days when conservatives and liberals alike could proudly call themselves Democrats, this meant the psychology of who we are as individuals, our personal identities, didn't factor as much into political discourse. Now that political coalitions are increasingly sorting psychologically, membership in a party takes on new meaning about who we are and what we value. When we do go to the ballot box, we're expressing who we are. Thus, the terms of all political debate suddenly become highly existential. Political identities have even transcended mere partisan concerns to include other cultural signifiers, from what food we eat or stores we shop at to what TV shows and movies we consume. Our political identities have transmogrified into mega-identities, heightening still the stakes of political debate. From Klein's perspective, the vitriol of political discourse cannot be understood from the degree of difference in each respective side's ideal tax policy or health care plan. We've grown increasingly intolerant of the other side because their existence is a threat to our identity and our relationship to the communities we cherish. Klein pithily sums it all up as such, and this is a quote from the book. When you vote for a candidate, you're not just voting for him or her. You're voting for, well, everything. You're voting for your side to beat the other side. You're voting to express your identity. You're voting so those smug jerks you fight with in comment sections don't win, so that aunt or uncle you argue with at Thanksgiving can't lord it over you. You're voting to say your group is right and worthy and the other group is wrong and unworthy. That's bigger than any one candidate for president. While that's not a ringing endorsement of the place we have landed politically, Klein's book is instructive in reminding us that just because the past seemed more calm, that didn't actually mean the country was living up to its highest ideals. Klein reminds us of the bitter irony of the much lauded golden years of bipartisanship in the 20th century, that the country was politically placid because such bipartisanship accommodated injustices faced by black people, women, and other marginalized groups. Our country is undoubtedly a very different place politically than it was in the 1950s and 60s. However, just because our politicians have much deeper disagreements than they did in the past does not mean the system is objectively worse. Klein wants us to be sober-minded about the pitfalls of polarization, but reflect on how far we've come since that so-called golden age that was far less democratic, far less liberal, and far less decent than today. and a very interesting book that was very popular at the Library for the Blind in September. Once again, it's called Why We're Polarized, and it was written by Ezra Klein. And we have time for one more book on our program for this month. This was one written by Chris Bojalian, who's a very popular author. It is entitled The Red Lotus, and it is from a review by Suzanne Byrne. What could be more suspenseful right now than the question of whether a virulent disease released into the world can be contained? Well, in a time filled with unnerving ironies and coincidences, another arrives in Chris Bojalian's most recent novel entitled The Red Lotus, which delves into biologically engineered pathogens and the possibility that profiteers and unscrupulous laboratory scientists have created a plague for sale. Bojalian specializes in well-researched topical thrillers with complex plots and flawed but principled heroes struggling with some of the world's most intractable problems. His 21 novels have involved homelessness, animal rights, human trafficking, and genocide, just to name a few. Several have also focused on ethical issues in alternative medicine, from midwifery to homeopathy. But with The Red Lotus, he has managed to be topical in a way he could not have predicted. Now, set over 10 days in Vietnam and New York, the novel opens with Alexis Remnick, a young ER doctor waiting by a hotel pool not far from Da Nang for her boyfriend, Austin. She's waiting for him to return from a bike trip into the mountains. Their romance began 6 months earlier when Austin, who is a fundraiser at her hospital, appeared in the ER with a bullet wound. He'd been at a Manhattan dive bar playing darts with a friend when a crazy junkie shot him by accident. She also treated what Austin claimed were cat bites on his fingertips. Not exactly a meet cute, Alexis reflects by the pool, but a good story to tell their children someday. Yet, where is Austin? This is the last day of their bike tour, his idea, a kind of pilgrimage to honor his father and uncle's service in Vietnam. Well, that morning he rode alone to the Hai Van Pass to be near where his father had been wounded and his uncle had died. But now he's late. Again, that's a popular book from September. It's called The Red Lotus by the popular author Chris Bojalian. And that's all the time we have for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately. I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind, simply Google or search for NC Library for the Blind or call toll-free 888-388-2460. You can also use the same numbers to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, our sponsor for this wonderful monthly feature. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Heard Any Good Books Lately will be available right after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time.